Hello and welcome to Playback.
Well, it is just after 1 a.m. here in the US Capitol. The very latest that we can report to you this morning is that the former President Donald Trump is leading the race to the White House. He has 246...
In the last couple of minutes, a number of media outlets in the United States have declared him the winner. Donald Trump has won the US presidential election, according to the US media.
The predictions were that this would be a knife-edge election and that it might take several days for the final result to emerge. Both predictions were wrong. Donald Trump will be returning to the White House, his victory an emphatic one.
That's how we heard the news as it unfolded on Wednesday morning. Oliver Callan immediately began the process of making sense of what it all means and how it happened.
Woke is dead, that's for sure. We now live in a bro universe where the Mad King is king and where the cultural icons are Elon Musk, Joe Rogan and the boss of UFC, who's also just invented a thing called the Big Slap, which is exactly what you're thinking about and it's exactly how Democrats feel right now this morning. The men who are the personification of those kind of throbbing neck veins, they are our new masters of the free world. It's the coalition of hair transplants, fake tans, deep fried congealed egos and doing their sex face when the rockets take off. That's America right now, and the young men of America, they surprised us all. They put down their gaming consoles, put on the hoodie that hasn't been washed since Hillary lost, and they voted for Donald Trump.
Having spent some time in the US in the run-up to Tuesday's election, RT reporter Jackie Fox had her own opinion about where it all went wrong for the Democrats when she spoke to Audrey on Morning Ireland.
The standout message for me over the last couple of days was there was a worry about Kamala Harris's final message, that Donald Trump was this threat to democracy, he was a fascist, and that's not exactly what people wanted to hear in the final moments. They wanted to hear about the economy. They wanted to hear about how their life was going to change.
She talked a lot about him, didn't she?
She did. And, you know, there was an indication around a month ago that most Americans, there was a New York Times poll, they said that, you know, the government isn't working for them and it's working to benefit itself and the elites. And Donald Trump had this successful message that the Democrats are the elites. And Kamala Harris, she played into that message by having endless celebrities, musicians, actors supporting her in the final moments. And I don't think that's what people needed to
see. Very wealthy people.
Very wealthy people.
Jackie Fox talking to Audrey Carvel on Wednesday. In another conversation about why the Democrats lost the election, speaking to Marion McKeown, Mary Wilson quoted a damning comment made by one of the party's former stalwarts.
Did Bernie Sanders call it when he said they abandoned working class people? And it's no surprise that working class people have abandoned them.
There are multiple facets to it. You cannot deny the role of racism and sexism, good old fashioned misogyny in this, because if you look at what the Trump campaign was selling, they were selling the ridicule of women, of Kamala Harris in particular. They were selling violence towards women. It was a bro macho, the swaggering machismo of it, women being denigrated, J.D. Vance leading the charge against women who didn't have children, as basically that's their function. You know, there was so much of that, and so much that was directed Kamala Harris. I have never heard rhetoric and vitriol and scorn heaped upon women so openly in any campaign. I think that was a big part of it. I think the white suburban women, just as they did with Hillary Clinton, they deserted Kamala Harris as well. So it wasn't just the men. And then there's a very interesting chap called Victor Martinez in Allentown in Pennsylvania, who owns a radio station, a Latino radio station. He said Hispanic men just don't want a woman in charge. He was very frank about it. He said they ain't going to vote for a woman. So I think there were a number of things, the economy as well, though, and the feeling that Joe Biden just didn't get it, that he was saying, look, everything's great, unemployment is low, inflation is back down, but he wasn't listening or understanding that people were really hurting.
Business Post reporter Marion McKeown. Another commentator on US politics who we've heard lots from in recent weeks and months, Notre Dame professor Bob Schmuel, also gave his reaction to Donald Trump's victory. Audrey asked him if he'd been surprised by it.
I am surprised, but I think it's additional evidence that he is probably the most consequential political figure in America since Franklin Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt, people might remember, won four separate presidential elections in the 30s and 1940s. And in Donald Trump's case, he has created this political movement that he talks about, and I think the election this time showed that it is expanding in its appeal. It's populist, it's nativist, it's working class, but now it has really a multiracial component to it that I think makes it even more enduring. He has made the Republican Party his own instrument of politics.
Professor Bob Schmuel, as heard on Wednesday's Morning Ireland. On Thursday's Drive Time, reporter John Cook paid a visit to Doombeg in County Clare, home of the Trump International Golf Links and Hotel.
Is everyone welcoming Donald Trump's return to the White House there today, John?
No, Cormac, and many people will tell you quietly they're not a fan of Donald Trump or his policies, but most I met declined to speak publicly, adding they have friends and family working in the Trump International Golf Resort nearby and wouldn't want to say anything against the president or his family for those reasons. For those who spoke, they didn't want to get involved in the controversy, but they welcomed the success of the hotel and resort since the Trumps took it over as its fourth owner in 2014. I spoke to many at McInerney's convenience shop, including John O'Loughlin and his little daughter. Their wild Irish farm business supplies produce to the Trump resort. He says the election result is a matter for the American people, but the man they've chosen has been good for the local economy here.
He is actually, they're lovely to deal with. As a business, I have sold to them. I do sell eggs in the local area and around, and I sell to them, and they were very good customers. They're very easy to deal with, never had an issue. It's very good for the local area like this now.
And even the negative commentary or his divisiveness, is there no such thing as bad publicity in terms of bringing business to the area?
I'm not one to fuss about that, you know. I just don't. I don't really want to deal with that stuff.
But the resort is good for this area.
Of course it is. Yeah. That is a positive business. You get the amount of Americans coming over. You go to restaurants, you can see the flags outside. It all brings business to the area.
Busy shop here today. Are you Trump supporters?
Yeah, we are. Definitely.
And why?
He's going to make a massive difference.
In what way?
He's just going to help the community.
Doombeg?
In Doombeg, yeah. Uh-huh.
As you know, with any employer, there's far-reaching effects. You know, there's more people living in the area. It's just good for our business and for our way of life, I suppose.
Have you ever met him?
No.
What do you think of his politics or him as a man?
I don't really have any opinion, to be honest with you, on his politics or... My thing is, better the devil you know than the devil you don't.
I know, I'd be apolitical myself, I'd say. Uh-huh. You know, just take a general interest, you know.
But what do you think of him?
Well, I don't know. As a businessman, he's done very well for West Clare. He's provided great employment for the locals here. I mean, if you didn't have the golf club, what would you have? A bereft community? Would they have to immigrate to Australia, Dubai, in those places, you know?
From Doombeg to Washington, D.C., the mood there was very different and very downbeat when Una Kelly went out to talk to people on the street, as she told Sarah on Drive Time.
There's a sense of catastrophizing before anything has actually changed here yet. This is a very different place and atmosphere to where we were in Michigan yesterday when I was speaking to you. There, it felt like many people were focused on their everyday lives and just ready to move on from this election cycle. But here in the center of political power, it's a one industry town. There are lots of people here who work in the sphere of politics, NGOs, lobbying. And rather than hearing from them, it is what it is. It seems people are still trying to come to terms with the result. We'll hear a bit now of what they had to say.
Very unhappy, kind of mourning the death of American democracy. That's about how I feel.
What are you anticipating the changes will be like?
The end of democracy. Project 2025 is a blueprint for eliminating Congress from having any impact. He can just ignore them. There's nothing they can do. So it's pretty depressing.
How are you feeling?
Just terrible. I have no hope for the future.
How do you think things might change?
I have no idea. It's just still getting used to it.
And to give us some perspective on why people who live and work in Washington are feeling so fearful, Una also spoke to veteran reporter Simon Marks.
This time round, they are talking about what is essentially here a revolution for Washington. They are talking about firing tens of thousands of career civil servants and replacing them only with loyalists, proven loyalists from Trump's Make America Great Again movement. And they are talking about appointing a cabinet that will have only, again, absolutely proven supporters and ideological fellow travellers with Donald Trump. So the notion that this time round Donald Trump's going to find a way of working with James Comey, for example, the former head of the FBI, or, you know, he had Rex Tillerson foisted on him as Secretary of State by Condoleezza Rice. There's going to be none of that. These people are almost to a person going to be ideologues. And that is not something this city has seen.
Are there any strong indications yet of particular personalities that could be brought in and key policy changes?
Well, I think that one key test of where Trump's administration is going to go will be who becomes Secretary of State. And Rick Grenell, who is the former U.S. ambassador to Germany under Trump, then played a role elsewhere within his administration, is hotly tipped to be the next Secretary of State. And he is an absolutely far-right fellow traveller of Donald Trump and will take U.S. foreign policy and the State Department to places it has never previously countenanced visiting. Robert Lighthizer, the man who created the tariffs policy, you know, Trump on the campaign trail a few weeks ago said tariffs is the most beautiful word in the English language, strong possibility that he's going to be economic advisor. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., lots of talk about the possibility of him moving to Health and Human Services. It seemed inconceivable a few days ago because how would he ever get Senate approval? But now the Republicans are going to control the Senate, so there could be no issue with that. And then, of course, there's the Musk factor. You know, for Elon Musk to get a cabinet position, he would not only have to get Senate approval, but he'd have to divest himself of his businesses, which seems unlikely. But Musk clearly is the Trump whisperer and is going to play a substantial role over the next 4 years.
On Thursday's Today Show, we also heard differing views on the prospect of Elon Musk and Robert Kennedy Jr. being at the forefront of President Trump-elect's new administration. First up is TJ Molloy of Democrats Abroad Ireland.
Just think an anti-vaxxer being involved in our national health policy is a pretty bad idea. I think just about everyone would agree with that. RFK has been denounced by pretty much everyone who knows him for the most part. But anyway, it's he's sure to have a position, I'm sure. Elon Musk would have a pretty big problem passing a background check. It looks like the Trump administration is going to be doing away with all the safeguards we have in place.
But because of the Republican success in this election, not only taking the presidency, but likely the House and the Senate as well, there's not much that you can do about any of these things.
Yeah, very little can be done. I mean, he's the president, the executive, but the guardrails are off. They're gone. This is not 2016.
Also in that same discussion, Greg Swenson, chairman of Republicans Overseas, took issue with the suggestion that Donald Trump will be giving Robert Kennedy Jr. free rein in his new administration.
I don't think there'll be RFK Jr. single-handedly deciding what healthcare...
That's what Donald Trump said the other night. Everything to do with healthcare...
Look at the actual context of that. At a campaign rally or at a closing statement, I'm going to let RFK Jr. go wild. Come on.
But again, what we're saying here and what you're saying to me is do not take the president-elect seriously. Do not take him at his word.
No, I'm saying take campaign statements with some understanding that it's a campaign discussion. Come on, Trump exaggerates. He likes to talk. He likes to speak freely. That's not policy. That's not written policy. So I would not let Trump derangement syndrome start to really color people again.
From Thursday's Today Show, John Bolton, who once served as national security advisor to Donald Trump, was a guest on Drive Time on Wednesday. At this point in the interview, Cormac O'Hara played a clip featuring a comment which Donald Trump made recently about John Bolton.
Her and that idiot John Bolton, who was so stupid. But I loved him. You know why? He'd come into a room with me, would never say anything, and I'd be with foreign leaders, and I didn't even have to act tough because he said, look, that moron, John Bolton, he's crazy. He's the one with Dick Cheney got Bush to go into the Middle East, right? Trump is going to go to war with us. And you know what happened? They give me everything I wanted because the guy's a nut job.
And after playing that clip, Cormac wondered if his guest was worried about the consequences of being an enemy of Donald Trump.
Well, I think the only solace is that the list is very long. And, you know, this will be a test of the Justice Department and the justice system if he really tries to go after people like Mark Milley, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He's threatened to call back to active duty and court-martial for treason, for calling his Chinese opposite number before January the 6th to say, look, don't be alarmed here. We were going to get through this. He did it at the request of the acting Secretary of Defense. It was the right thing to do. But
you served under him, John. You've been disloyal, according to him. Should you be worried, do you think?
Yeah, as I say, I think I'm on the list along with a cast of thousands. We'll see how far down the list I rank and how far down the list he gets.
The impact which Donald Trump's election is likely to have in Gaza and Ukraine was also discussed by a number of commentators on air this week. In another conversation on Drive Time, former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert differentiated between Donald Trump on the campaign trail and as president.
There is one big difference between what was up until now and from now on. And this is that Donald Trump knows that he will have no more election campaigns in his life. This is the end. You know, he was, I think, somewhat careful or sensitive to the possible ramifications of certain opinions about the public opinion in America, and particularly the Jewish public opinion. Now he doesn't have to worry about this. Therefore, there is a likelihood. Now that he is president, okay, it doesn't matter what we may have wanted before the election, but now that he's president-elect, he might as well just stick to the basic fundamental attitudes that characterize him. He's against wars. He doesn't want to be involved in wars for America. And Netanyahu, together with Biden brought American carriers into the Middle East and atomic submarines and American planes because he said to the Iranians, if you guys will attack Israel, we are here to fight together with Israel. I'm not certain that Trump is in the same line. So he may create an entirely new environment whereby Israel will not be able to rely on the automatic support of the American administration for any adventure that Netanyahu will attempt to carry Israel to.
Former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, as heard on Thursday's Drive Time, and from one election to another.
Here we go, Simon Harris.
To Orison Uchtaron, to advise President Higgins, pursuant to Section 2 of Article 13 of our Constitution, to dissolve Dáil Éireann, to allow a general election to be held on Friday, the 29th of November.
Simon Harris eventually confirmed the date for this year's general election on Friday. And in anticipation of that announcement, Katie Hannan and Fran McNulty popped into the Morning Ireland studio to talk about the new election podcast they're doing with David McCullough.
I'm looking forward to having this election mansplained to me by David and Fran.
We wouldn't dare.
This is our Olympics, aren't you? This is us. It only comes around every 4 or 5 years.
And already well warmed up, Fran went on to discuss what kind of election he thinks it's likely to be.
I think, Anya, it's going to be fiery. If you saw the clamour in the coalition to simply announce the date, Roderick O'Gorman 3 weeks ago out of the traps before anyone else. Simon Harris is on his way out here to RTE to confirm the date, and Micheál Martin is rushing to Virgin Media to get there before him. It's extraordinary. And then you looked at leaders' questions yesterday. Seán Éireann trying to keep control of a chamber that was erupting with energy, and that's what we're going to get because, as you say, it's a short campaign. People need to get out there and make an impression. That's going to make our job fun.
There's a lot of talk from pundits and so on. You'll hear an awful lot of predictions already today. There are people out telling you how many seats one party will get, how many seats another party will get. The only thing I've learned in all these years of covering politics is nobody knows. No. And at some point in the campaign, something will happen where you might think, yeah, that there might be something in and around that. Isn't that the case?
That's it. Every single campaign I have ever covered, there has been a moment in that campaign where you felt the ground shifting underneath you.
And we'll see them all coming out each day for the different parties, and also, and you know, in the constituencies, you'll be seeing whatever independents are running, and they'll all have a plan and they'll all have their talking points. But I suppose campaigns, like battles, they don't survive contact with the enemy. So it's that dynamic.
From Friday's Morning Ireland. And later that morning, Kevin Doyle, Group Head of News at Independent Newspapers, was a guest on the Today Show. Now, you know when politicians tell us that the only poll they're interested in is the one on election day? Well, according to Kevin, they're lying.
The one thing, Claire, I'd say about polls is I've listened to politicians and I've no doubt they've sat here with straight faces telling you, we don't care about polls, we don't listen to polls.
All the time.
Polls has no impact on what we're planning or what way we're going to do with that. Those very same people, Claire, who sit here and tell you that are texting me whenever there's a poll in the Sunday Independent on a Saturday going, any steer, anything going on? And I'm sure they do it, Clare, when it's in the Sunday Times or wherever else. The parties are obsessed, the politicians are obsessed with the polls. So it, any of them that come in here over the campaign and tell you it doesn't influence how they think.
I'd say Kevin said.
Well, it's true. It's true.
And in another election discussion on the News at One, reporter Barry Lenehan had an example of how some local politicians in South Dublin were tripping over themselves to be the bearers of good news.
GAA is a key factor in this election.
Isn't it always?
And of course, we talked about the inter-coalition transfer. But in Dún Laoghaire, you have three coalition TDs going hammer and tongs at each other and only two will survive. So this is where you have Richard Boyd Barrett will come home for the People Before Profit. Fine Gael have a seat with Jennifer Carroll McNeill, Fianna Fáil with Cormac Devlin, the Green Party with Oisín Smith. This is high on Fine Gael's target list of gains in the Safe and Mound Street. But all three coalition partners were apparently claiming credit for the new clubhouse at Coola on Monday. Coola, the Dublin football champions. Cormac Devlin had a press release out at 6 o'clock in the morning. Oisín Smith was big up on TikTok on it, and the news was broken to the club by Fine Gael's Jennifer Carroll McNeill. So
all politics is certainly local, but and out that way they don't have the benefit of a local radio station either, so they really do
really
have to rely on the social media.
From Friday's News at One. We're all sad to hear the news that Kathleen Watkins had passed away in the early hours of Thursday morning. On Liveline that afternoon, former RTÉ broadcaster Mike Murphy recalled some of the time he spent with Kathleen in recent years.
Just in the past couple of years, we'd often meet her up in Herbert Park, and we'd arrange to meet, and she would come out, and she used to wear an old pair of, she'd park the car in a disabled car parking, and then she was on the sticks at the time, and she'd come over to the same seat, and before she came out, she'd pull on a pair of really woolly socks, long woolly socks to keep her warm, and any old coat that she could find or hat that she could find to come out. And I remember one occasion, Annie went off to do something and left the two of us sitting on a seat. And she said she came back and we were like a pair of, if you want to say deadbeats, I don't mean that in an unkind way, sitting there. And the two of us hooting with laughter. She was just such a refined, erudite, interested woman. And I don't know how often we'd meet her, and she's on her way tonight to the National Concert Hall or to the Olympia.
The Abbey, to a Brian Friel play.
There was hardly a Brian Friel play that was staged that she wasn't at nearly every performance. Yeah. Like, she was a great friend of the Friels, and she was just one special woman.
And later in the programme, Kathleen's daughter Susie spoke to Joe about how all the family got to spend time with Kathleen before she died. She also remembered her dad, Gay Byrne, who died 5 years ago this month, and how her parents handled being in the public eye.
She would always have said that Dad was extraordinarily patient, you know, with everybody, and he gave of himself to everybody that met him, whether it was walking down Grafton Street in the theatre and everything. And their attitude and his attitude was, this is what we do, this is what we signed up for. And she would always have said if they were out for dinner, that if she went to the toilet, she never came back, but there wasn't somebody sitting in her seat, always. So they generally kind of went out to restaurants with people, other people. But they were so dedicated to each other. And I think because of their life and their life in the arts, she was able to keep her interests up. And he always encouraged her to do things like go to London or go to the theatre, various things, so she could then report back to him. And I mean, I think as Mike was saying, she saw Dancing at Lunasa. She was with Anne Friel. They travelled the world. She said she saw Dancing at Lunasa in about 6 or 7 languages. Any excuse. And in order to ensure that everything was as they wished, they would always bring little slices of lemon with them to go to London or Frankfurt or wherever they're going for the little gin and tonic to make sure, because sometimes in these places you wouldn't necessarily get the slice of lemon.
Oh, God,
so this was very important. So that would be sliced and ready in the tinfoil.
Kathleen Watkins' daughter Susie remembering her mum who died on Thursday. So come on, let it go. That's Robbie Dolan, who is a contestant in The Voice Australia in 2022. He was back in the news this week, however, because he won the Melbourne Cup. Robbie's from Kildare, and on Tuesday he spoke to another Kildare man, Ray Darcy. Ray asked Robbie if he manages to keep his singing and jockeying careers on the go at the same time.
Not really. It's funny, when I was doing the singing, the jockeying took a break, and then I kind of missed the racing and wanted to get back into the racing, and then the singing took a break, but It's just, I've got a weird life, Ray. I'll tell you one thing.
You do have a weird life.
We were driving down the road after winning the cup, just going back to have a few drinks somewhere, and people recognise me in the car.
Right.
It's just mental. It's the biggest race in Australia. It's one of the biggest races in the whole world. It's just crazy, to be honest.
There's a movie in you. There's definitely a movie in you.
There could be a movie in me. Yeah. Brad Pitt. Brad Pitt playing me. Who's going to play you? You have to play yourself.
Some small bald man. Listen, I was just reading the brief from the last time and I laughed out loud because your dad, Bobby, who's there, and Paula, formerly Paula Matthews, they were at a disco and I was DJing and that was their first dance, was it?
Yes, that was their first dance.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm partly responsible for your existence in a way.
So to be honest, without you, somebody else would have won the Melbourne Cup today.
There you go. Huh? Oh, this is going to be a great movie. This is going to be a great
movie. So technically you won the Melbourne Cup.
From the Ray Darcy Show on Tuesday.
How did I find myself, you know, sitting in a studio with Claire Byrne, lying to her about why I was leaving politics?
Well, thanks for coming back and telling us the truth.
That's former Fine Gael Minister Owen Murphy, who has just written a book about his time in politics. The lies he's referring to relate to an interview he did with Claire Byrne in 2021, during which he spoke about his reasons for exiting politics. At this stage in the interview, Claire mentions a review his book received last weekend.
Owen O'Brien was, the Sinn Féin spokesperson, was asked to review the book for the Irish Times. Now, he did say that you had courage to lay bare your time in office and it's done future ministers a service and so on. But he said your naivety, lack of political experience, shallow political base and even shallower understanding of housing policy made your failure inevitable and that you should never have been appointed as Minister for Housing. What do you think of that?
That's lovely. I mean, look, I've written a book. I've been honest about the challenges that I faced. I've talked a little bit about some of the things that I did or tried to do, but the book isn't meant to be a defense of my time in housing. It's not meant to be something to try and restore a reputation or to take shots at other people. I thought that, you know, if I wrote this properly and wrote it in a way that people enjoyed reading it, they might learn a bit more about how politics works.
During the course of the interview, Owen Murphy admitted that he had been particularly stung by a criticism levelled at him while he was minister by the current housing minister, Dara O'Brien, who described him as being too cosseted for the job.
I just wonder when Dara O'Brien said that about you being too cosseted, did it hurt because, was there an element of truth in it?
No. What? That because of?
Because you, and you say this in the book, you come from a middle class upbringing. You know, South Dublin and so on, that maybe you didn't understand it.
I gave every, I mean, what do we want from our politicians? I mean, it depends. It's a question. Like, I mean, do we want to decide that their background should be disqualifying factors? I mean, I never hid where I was from. I mean, I was very honest about where I'm from. Mm. I've had great opportunities. And one of the things that I wanted to do going into politics, because it was how I was raised, was to see if I could help people have the opportunities that they weren't having that I had had. I think that's a good motivation for public service, and I believe in public service. And I think that, you know, we shouldn't be focused so much on our politicians' backgrounds, but on what they're actually trying to do and what they're saying.
The team that you had right from the beginning when you were elected as a councillor, when you first decided you were going into politics, they stuck with you the whole way through.
Yeah,
Some of them were disappointed in you at the end. Is that a fair characterisation?
Yeah, like, I mean, there was a moment I remember meeting someone from one of my first campaigns on the street who'd been super enthusiastic about me getting into politics and everything else, and he could barely look at me because what he had seen of me since becoming a minister was either what was being portrayed in the media or what I was portraying of myself through social media. I mean, my God, I look back at some of the tweets that I did and they're cringe. It's embarrassing. You know, I'm trying to project.
What about the cow?
Yeah.
Does that come to mind where you said, I didn't know this is where the milk from my latte came from.
Yeah, you know, and I was thought that was hilarious, you know, but I was an idiot. So, you know, people were really concerned about what was happening in housing. I hadn't brought a coherent plan because I'd wanted to, but I had let myself kind of be persuaded not to actually announce something. My mistake. But I hadn't brought a coherent plan. People were wondering what was going on. And I'm running around in my togs, tweeting about cows and going for swims and, you know, doing all this stuff. And I didn't understand at the time just what a massive mistake I was making in my presentation.
You can see now why I would ask you that question about, you know, Dara O'Brien saying that you were too cosseted. It was almost the image that you were portraying. I have a lovely life here.
I know. I mean, unfortunately, I don't have a time machine to go back.
From Today with Claire Byrne on Wednesday. A book about David Marcus, the one-time editor of the New Irish Writing Page in the Irish Press, was up for discussion on Wednesday night's Arena. Sebastian Barry spoke to Sean about the book and his own dealings with David Marcus.
It is a wonderful contradiction, and maybe something to put in the balance for De Valera, that his newspaper carried New Irish Writing when it did, and rather fearlessly, and allowing David his head, as it were, with what he wanted to publish, even though it's beautifully expressed in this book that when Beckett said he would send something, David Marcus was very worried that actually he might send something that he couldn't publish unedited in the press. And how on earth would he say it to Samuel Beckett? You know, and ditto Edna O'Brien, that he was afraid it would be very racy, but was determined not to edit in a disreputable way. In other words, he wasn't going to tailor his writers to some of the horrible constrictions of Irish life. And I think that defines him. I mean, in many ways, he presented him. Anita Daly has a lovely memoir of the two of them. Yeah. Very, very many ways, a very conventional sort of a geezer. And yet, he had this crazy maverick gift of identifying these strange young people in their lairs, if they had something beautiful to publish.
And one of those young people happened to be Sebastian Barry.
I thought you had to go to Paris. And after Trinity, that's where I went with my then, you know, my wonderful girlfriend, Gina McGilligan. We set off to Paris to be proper Irish writers. She, for her sins, or my sins possibly, was teaching English to support us. But we were incredibly poor, and we'd buy a bag of vegetables every week to eat, and that's all we had. We'd buy un pain every day and cut it into four pieces, you know, this sort of thing, in a little chambre de bonne at the top in the Rue Clotaire beside the Pantheon, ironically, where all the great are remembered. And I had in me what every young writer, I do believe, needs, which was an insane estimation of myself, because you better have that, because you're not going to survive this experience. Gina also had quite a high opinion of my work, but there was only the two of us in this chambre de bonne, semi-starving. I had sent David a very dense, clotted, sub-Joycean, sub-Beckettian piece, and he wrote me a little postcard saying virtually that, but in much politer terms, and saying, but I think you have a bit of talent, and if you write anything else, let me know. And write anything else. I mean, I had published poetry, but I had literally nothing to send him after the dense, clotted thing. So I worked on this story called The Beast for about 4 months in my room, and then we went off to Paris. And then suddenly, some signal day, unrecorded in anyone's history but my own, a letter came saying he was going to publish The Beast. And I can't really properly describe to you the racketing joy that is in your head when somebody besides you and Gina has decided that maybe you're not wasting your time. He just changed our world in that little room in Paris with this one gesture of noticing.
Sebastian Barry in conversation with Sean Rocks on Wednesday's Arena. John Boyne was Oliver Callan's guest in studio on Thursday. He was in to talk about the latest book in his series, which deals with the theme of abuse. John has spoken openly in the past about how he himself was abused as a child. He told Oliver that he's in a really good place now.
I feel very much that it's important to say to anybody who's gone through something like this in their life that you do not want to spend your life being somebody else's victim. You know, you can get past that. You can not make your peace with something that happened to you, but you can say, well, it was part of my life. It happened. And I feel no shame about it. And nobody should. And it's good to be able to talk about it. In my case, it's great to be able to write about it. It's part of my story. It's part of my history. But there's 100 things that are part of my story and part of my history. And I make the adult choice not to let it be any bigger a part of my life than it needs to be.
John also spoke about being in love.
I am. I'm a smitten kitten. I have. Listen to me giggling. Giggling like a schoolgirl. I'll probably get told off for that. So, 3 months, and we had our first romantic weekend away. And This is what screams romance. We went to Paris, which does scream romance, but stayed in the hotel that Oscar Wilde died in, and the room Oscar Wilde died in. And that, you know, I'm the last of the, you know, great romantics.
Is the wallpaper still there?
That's right, wasn't it? Like, either the wallpaper has to go or I do.
Yes. Yeah,
so, so that was lovely. And yeah, like, life is really, really pretty great at the moment.
John Boyne talking to Oliver Callan on Thursday. This week's drama on One was Colin Murphy's play Haughey Gregory, which told the true story of the deal agreed by Charlie Haughey and independent TD Tony Gregory back in 1982.
Once a government has been elected, they will receive my support only insofar as they pursue the programme of agreed commitments. Beg me a vote all Marshin our son on Chopped O'Hookig to Tolkhan Lahayag on Tishan.
I am putting the question that Deputy Charles J. Haughey be nominated Taoiseach.
And so the deal is done. The Gregory deal, as it'll be forever known. To read about it in the Irish Times the next day, you'd think it's a deal to sign away the firstborns of every couple in the state, rather than a programme of investment in one of its poorest communities. So we get started on implementing it, and Charlie is as good as his word. Planning starts for the houses, the school, the Docklands, a new inner city development authority. But then in the middle of August, don't they catch a murderer? Malcolm MacArthur in the apartment of the Attorney General?
Taoiseach.
Mr. Haughey.
Taoiseach, can you explain what's going on?
Can you explain what the Attorney General was doing
Taoiseach,
at the time?
Taoiseach, one question. Please take one question.
It was a bizarre happening, non-precedented situation, a grotesque situation, an almost unbelievable mischance.
In the meantime, the national finances are a disaster. Charlie launches a new austerity drive, but then Fianna Fáil loses two TDs. One has a heart attack, another dies. Suddenly, Charlie doesn't have the numbers. Fine Gael call a no-confidence vote and Charlie's government collapses. And that's the end of the Gregory deal. Some of the houses get built. We get the community school, Larkin College, though. Takes 17 years. The motorway's killed off for good. Thank God. And the docks is transformed. Though an international financial services centre isn't quite what we had in mind for a community facility. In the meantime, Charlie's money catches up with him. By the time he dies in 2006, he's been pretty well humiliated. And then cancer catches up with Tony in 2008. Now that's the year the bank guarantee and the budget that follows it is ferocious. Tony goes into the Dáil to speak against the education cuts that are coming in. A teacher to the last. He's terribly thin. Labour has a motion down against cuts. And Tony goes looking to them for speaking time. Because, well, that's how the system works. As an independent, he has to beg for his time from the parties. And they don't give it to him. And that was his last time in the Dáil. He dies 2 months later in January 2009 at 61.
Sunday's drama on One, Haughey Gregory, written by Colin Murphy and produced by Kevin Brew. Black American poet Gustav Parker Hibbett read a poem for this week's Poetry People. In it, she describes an encounter she had with the police.
Other people's fear keeps me up at night. After Morgan Parker. At the train station, there is a church bell ringing in my chest, or trying to. Muffled clapper, reaching out for one lip, then the other, striking only leather. A man has stopped me getting off the train to Kansas City, and the river of the other passengers is passing noiselessly around me, the island of my suitcase open, spilling clothes and books and sleeping bag onto the platform. I am not allowed to touch, like at the airport, so I watch him root, untidy everything, just in case you're bringing drugs or something. He calls over another man, a search dog, while every other passenger flows past me. While we wait, he asks me if I go to college at the institution stamped across my sweatshirt. Won't believe me when I tell him, yes, I do. Twinkles like he's caught me in a lie. It's mid-August, so I should be there already. Now he wants to take my sleeping bag out of its stuff sack. I try to tell him that we start in late September, but there's something in my chest that keeps on stopping short of sound, prayer that goes to kneel and keeps on falling, keeps on finding nothing solid. I could be lying, could be anything he says I am. It's 2 weeks since Michael Brown. My hands are shaking, but he almost smiles when he tells me that he might need to take me to his office. Easy as someone might tell me that it's raining, that they might be having casserole for dinner.
From Sunday's Poetry People. Last week's documentary on One, A Letter Home, produced by Tim Desmond, featured letters spanning a number of decades collected in an archive of correspondence between Irish immigrants to the US and their families and loved ones back home. Here's a particularly sad letter written from a father to a son.
Another Donegal letter that caught my eye is of a life coming to an end, written from a heartbroken father in the hills of Donegal.
Not from America to Ireland, but from Ireland to America. And it's a letter from a man called Columbus Rorty, so Colum O'Rorty, who's writing from Mean Corwick in the Derryvay Mountains to a son in 1877 in America who has been convicted of involvement in the activities of the Molly Maguires, a secret society of Irish miners, a trade union, effectively, of Irish miners who were resisting a very harsh regime in the mines. And his son has been condemned to death, and he writes, "Dear loving son, I sit to write you the last letter that ever I'll write again, and don't be afraid to meet your doom or your judge. If you're going to suffer innocent, I'm sure God will spare your soul, and it's far better to suffer in this world than in the world to come. No matter how long we suffer in this cursed world, it's nothing beside eternity."
From last week's documentary on One, A Letter Home, produced by Tim Desmond. Arena dedicated its entire programme on Wednesday to the launch of this year's Winter Papers. Co-editor Kevin Barry has written an essay for this year's edition, from which he read an excerpt.
Over the years, we became wiser to the Central Hotel. If sleep was badly needed, the solid move was to ask for a room on the Dame Court side. Once the Stag's Head and the Dame Tavern had chucked out for the night, the side street fell into a few hours of relative quiet, and your dreams might be disturbed only by the occasional melodious drunkard or the yowling of a lonesome dog. If you were in a room on the Georgia Street side, by contrast, you might as well still be out on the tiles yourself, with the raucousness and the beats rolling on until three at the Globe, and Socratic debates erupting outside the fried chicken establishments, and the shrieks and shattered glass of all the broken romances. After that, it was only an hour or two until the infernal swooshing of the street cleaning machines put paid to the notion of sleep altogether, and then there was the irritated chugging of the early traffic and the rolling in of the beer barrels and little thumps when they landed on the burlap sacks and the furious mwarking of the homicidal gulls, and Dublin town generally coughing its lungs up of a morning like the haggard old lag that it is, and you're lying there, bug-eyed on the wrong side of the Central Hotel, with the twisted sheets of insomnia caught up in the crack of your arse, and God, how I miss it all now.
That's about my lot for this week. Staying with that live edition of Arena, a band called Houseplants performed a couple of tracks. This one is called Every Flower is a Field. I'm Fiona Kelly. I hope you enjoyed the programme. So until next time, goodbye.